You know, Andre, I can remember when the world shook with fear of our country's army. Now they shake with laughter, those who bother to take note of us. Bondarenko took a sip of vodka from a flask. It had been a long time since he'd drunk alcohol on duty, but it was cold. The heater in the car was broken, and he needed the solace. Gennady Yosifovich, it is not as bad as it appears.
I agree, it is worse, Sink Far East growled. If the Chinks come north, I shall learn to eat with chopsticks. I've always wondered how they do that, he added with a wry smile.
Bondarenko was always one to see the humor in a situation. But to others we appear strong. We have thousands of tanks, Comrade General. Which was true. They'd spent the morning inspecting monstrous sheds containing, of all things, T-34 85 tanks manufactured at Chelyabinsk in 1946. Some had virgin guns, never fired. The Germans had shaken in their jackboots to see these tanks storm over the horizon. But that's what they were. World War II tanks. Over 900 of them. 3 complete division sets. And there were even troops to maintain them. The engines still turned over, serviced as they were by the grandchildren of the men who'd used them in combat operations against the fascisti. And in the same sheds were shells, some made as recently as 1986, for the 85mm guns. The world was mad, and surely the Soviet Union had been mad, first to store such antiques, then to spend money and effort maintaining them. And even now, more than 10 years after the demise of that nation-state, the sheer force of bureaucratic inertia still sent conscripts into the sheds to maintain the antique collection. For what purpose? No one knew. It would take an archivist to find the documents, and while that might be of interest to some historian of a humorous bent, Bondarenko had better things to do.
Andrei, I appreciate your willingness to see the lighter side of every situation, but we do face a practical reality here.
Comrade General, it will take months to get permission to terminate this operation.
That is probably true, Andrushka. But I remember a story about Napoleon. He wished to plant trees by the side of the French roads to shade his marching troops. A staff officer said, but Marshal, it will take 20 years for the trees to grow enough to accomplish that. And Napoleon said, yes, indeed, so we must start at once.
And so, Colonel, we will start with that at once.
As you say, Comrade General. Colonel Aliyev knew that it was a worthwhile idea. He only wondered if he would have enough time to pursue all of the ideas that needed accomplishing. Besides, the troops at the tank shed seemed happy enough. Some even took the tanks out into the open to play with them, drive them about the nearby test range, even shoot the guns occasionally. One young sergeant had commented to him that it was good to use them, because it made the war movies he'd seen as a child seem even more real. Now that, Colonel Aliyev thought, was something to hear from a soldier. It made the movies better. Damn.
Who does that slant-eyed motherfucker think he is? Gant demanded out in the garden.
Mark, we laid a rather firm note on them this morning, and they're just reacting to it.
Cliff explained to me why it's okay for other people to talk like that to us, but it's not okay for us to talk that way to them, will you?
It's called diplomacy. Rutledge explained.
It's called horseshit, Cliff, Gant hissed back. Where I come from, if somebody disses you like that, you punch him right in the face.
But we don't do that.
Why not?
Because we're above it, Mark, Rutledge tried to explain. It's the little dogs that yap at you. The big, powerful dogs don't bother. They know they can rip your head off. And we know we can handle these people if we have to.
Somebody needs to tell them that, Cliffy, Gant observed, because I don't think they got the word yet. They're talking like they own the world, and they think they can play tough guy with us, Cliff, and until they find out they can't, We're going to have a lot more of their shit to deal with.
Mark, this is how it's done, that's all. It's just how the game is played at this level.
Oh, yeah? Gant countered. Cliff, it's not a game to them.
I see that, but you don't.
After this break, we're going back in there, and they're going to threaten us.
What do we do then?
We brush it off. How can they threaten us?
The Boeing order.
Well, Boeing will have to sell its airplanes to somebody else this year, Rutledge said.
Really? What about the interests of all those workers we're supposed to represent?
Mark, at this level, we deal with the big picture, not the little one, okay?
Rutledge was actually getting angry with this stock trader.
Cliffy, the big picture is made up of a lot of little ones. You ought to go back in there and ask if they like selling things to us, because if they do, then they have to play ball, because they need us a fucking lot more than we need them.
You don't talk that way to a great power.
Are we a great power?
The biggest, Rutledge confirmed.
Then how come they talk that way to us?
Mark, this is my job. You're here to advise me, but this is your first time to this sort of ball game, okay? I know how to play the game. It's my job.
Fine. Gant let out a long breath.
But when we play by the rules and they don't, the game gets a little tedious.
Gant wandered off on his own for a moment. The garden was pretty enough. He hadn't done this sort of thing enough to know that there was usually a garden of some sort for diplomats to wander in after 2 or 3 hours of talking at each other in a conference room. But he had learned that the garden was where a lot of the real work got done.
Mr. Gant?
He turned to see Shui Ma, the diplomat, Spook, he'd chatted with before.
Mr. Shui? Telescope said in his own greeting.
What do you think of the progress of the talks? The Chinese diplomat asked.
Mark was still trying to understand this guy's use of language.
If this is progress, I'd hate to see what you call an adverse development.
Shui smiled.
A lively exchange is often more interesting than a dull one.
Really, I'm surprised by all this. I always thought that diplomatic exchange was more polite.
You think this impolite?
Gant again wondered if he was being baited or not, but decided, the hell with it. He didn't really need his government job anyway, did he? And taking it had involved a considerable personal sacrifice, hadn't it? Like a few $1 million? Didn't that entitle him to say what the hell he thought?
Shui, you accuse us of threatening your national identity because we object to the murders your government, or its agents, I suppose, committed in front of cameras. Americans don't like it when people commit murder.
Those people were breaking our laws, Shui reminded him.
Maybe so, Gant conceded. But in America, when people break the law, we arrest them and give them a trial in front of a judge and jury, with a defense lawyer to make sure the trial is fair, and we damn sure don't shoot people in the head when they're holding a goddamned newborn infant.
That was unfortunate, Shui almost admitted. But, as I said, those men were breaking the law.
And so your cops did the judge, jury, executioner number on them.
Shui, to Americans, that was the act of a barbarian. The B word finally got through.
America cannot talk to China in that way, Mr. Gant.
Look, Mr. Shui, it's your country, and you can run your country as you wish. We're not going to declare war on you for what you do inside your own borders. But there's no law that says we have to do business with you either, and so we can stop buying your goods. And I have news for you. The American people will stop buying your stuff if you continue to do stuff like that.
Your people?
Or your government? Shui asked, with a knowing smile.
Are you really that stupid, Mr. Shui? Gant fired back.
What do you mean?
The last insult had actually cracked through the shell, Gant saw.
I mean America is a democracy. Americans make a lot of decisions entirely on their own, and one of them is what they spend their money on. And the average American will not buy something from a fucking barbarian.
Gant paused. Look, I'm a Jew, okay? 60-some years ago, America fucked up. We saw what Hitler and the Nazis were doing in Germany, and we didn't act in time to stop it. We really blew the call, and a lot of people got killed unnecessarily. And we've been seeing things on TV about that since I was in short pants, and it ain't never going to happen again on our watch. And when people like you do stuff like what we just saw, it just sets off the Holocaust light in American heads. Do you get it now? You cannot talk to us in that way. Again with the broken record. The doors were opening. It was time to head back inside for the next round of confrontational diplo-speak. And if you persist in attacking our national sovereignty, we will buy elsewhere, Shui told him with some satisfaction. Fine, and we can do the same. And you need our cash a lot more than we need your trade goods, Mr. Shui. He must have finally understood, Gant thought. His face actually showed some emotion now. So did his words. We will never kowtow to American attacks on our country. We're not attacking your country, Shui. But you threaten our economy, Shui said as they got to the door. We threaten nothing. I am telling you that my fellow citizens will not buy goods from a country that commits barbarities. That is not a threat, it is a statement of fact. Which was an even greater insult, Gant did not fully appreciate. If America punishes us, we will punish America. Enough was goddamned enough. Gant pulled the door open halfway and stopped to face the diplomat, Spook. Shui, your dicks aren't big enough to get in a pissing contest with us. And with that, he walked on inside. A half hour later, he was on his way out again. The words had been sharp and heated, and neither side had seen any purpose in continuing that day. Though Gant strongly suspected that once Washington heard about that morning's exchanges, there wouldn't be any other day. In 2 days, he'd be totally jet-lagged, but back at his office on 15th Street. He was surprised that he was looking forward to that. Anything from Westpac? Mancuso asked. They just put 3 submarines to sea, a Song and 2 of the Kilos the Russians sold them, B.G. Lahr answered. We're keeping an eye on them. La Jolla and Helena are close by. Tennessee is heading back to Pearl as of midday. The former boomer had been on patrol for 50 days, and that was about enough. Our surface assets are all back to sea. Nobody's scheduled to get back into Taipei for 12 days. So the Taipei hookers get 2 weeks off? Sink Pack asked, with a chuckle. And the bartenders? If your sailors are like my soldiers, they may need the relaxation, the J-2 replied, with a smile of his own. Oh, to be young and single again, Bart observed. Anything else out there? Routine training on their side, some combined air and ground stuff, but that's up north by the Russian border. How good do they look? Lahr shrugged. Good enough to give the Russians something to think about, sir. On the whole, the PLA is trained up as good as I've ever known them to be, but they've been working hard for the past 3 or 4 years. How many of them? Bart asked, looking at his wall map, which was a lot more useful for a sailor than a soldier. China was just a beige shape on the left border. Depends on where. Like, if they go north into Russia, it'd be like cockroaches in some ghetto apartment in New York. You'd need a lot of raid to deal with it. And you said the Russians are thin in their east? Lahr nodded. Yep. Admiral, if I was that Bondarenko guy, I'd sweat it some. I mean, it's all theoretical as a threat and all, but as theoretical threats go, that's one that might keep me awake at night. And what about reports of gold and oil in eastern Siberia? Lahr nodded. Makes the threat less theoretical. China's a net importer of oil, and they're going to need a lot more to expand their economy the way they plan to. And on the gold side, hell, everybody's wanted that for the last 3,000 years. It's negotiable and fungible.
Fungible?
That was a new word for Mancuso.
Your wedding band might have been part of Pharaoh Ramses II's Double Crown once,
Blar explained.
Or Caligula's necklace, or Napoleon's royal scepter. You take it, hammer it, and it's just raw material again. And it's valuable raw material. If the Russian strike's as big as our intel says, it'll be sold all over the world. Everybody'll use it for all sorts of purposes, from jewelry to electronics.
How big's the strike supposed to be?
Lars shrugged.
Enough to buy you a new Pacific fleet, and then some.
Mancuso whistled. That was real money.
It was late in Washington, and Adler was up late, again, working in his office. Sextate was usually a busy post, and lately it had been busier than usual, and Scott Adler was getting accustomed to 14-hour days. He was reading over post reports at the moment, waiting for the other shoe to drop in Beijing. On his desk was a Stu 6 secure telephone. The secure telephone unit was a sophisticated encryption device grafted onto an AT&T-made digital telephone. This one worked on a satellite communications channel, and though its signal therefore sprinkled down all over the world from its Defense Department communications satellite, all the casual listener would get was raspy static, like the sound of water running out of a bathroom faucet. It had a randomized 512-bit scrambling system that the best computers at Fort Meade could break about a third of the time after several days of directed effort. And that was about as secure as things got. They were trying to make the tap dance encryption system link into the Stu units to generate a totally random and hence unbreakable signal. But that was proving difficult, for technical reasons that nobody had explained to the Secretary of State, and that was just as well. He was a diplomat, not a mathematician. Finally, the Stu rang in its odd trilling warble. It took 11 seconds for the two Stu units on opposite sides of the world to synchronize.
Adler.
Rutledge here, Scott, the voice said on the other side of the world.
It didn't go well, he informed Sextate at once.
And they're canceling the 777 order with Boeing, as we thought they would.
Adler frowned powerfully into the phone.
Super. No concessions at all on the shootings?
Zip.
Anything to be optimistic about?
Nothing, Scott. Not a damn thing. They're stonewalling like we're the Mongols and they're the Qin Dynasty.
Somebody needs to remind them that the Great Wall ultimately turned out to be a waste of bricks, Eagle didn't bother saying aloud.
Okay, I need to discuss this with the President, but you're probably going to be flying home soon.
Maybe Carl Hitch, too.
I'll tell him. Any chance that we can make some concession just to get things going?
Cliff, the likelihood that Congress will roll over on the trade issue is right up there with Tufts making the Final Four.
Maybe less.
Tufts University did have a basketball team, after all.
There's nothing we can give them that they would accept. If there's going to be a break, they're the ones who'll have to bend this time.
Any chance of that?
Zero, was the reply from Beijing.
Well, then, they'll just have to learn the hard way.
The good news, Adler thought, was that the hard lessons were the ones that really did teach you something.
Maybe even the Chinese.
What did that capitalist Jia Ren say? Zhang asked.
Shen told him what Shui had relayed word for word.
And what does he represent?
He is personal assistant to the American Treasury Minister. Therefore we think he has the ear of both his minister and the American President,
Shen explained.
He has not taken an active part in the talks, but after every session he speaks privately with Vice Minister Rutledge.
Exactly what their relationship is we do not know for certain, and clearly he is not an experienced diplomat.
He talks like an arrogant capitalist, to insult us in so crude a way. but I fear he represents the American position more forthrightly than Rutledge does. I think he gives Rutledge the policy he must follow. Rutledge is an experienced diplomat, and the positions he takes are not his own, obviously. He wants to give us some concessions. I am sure of that. But Washington is dictating his words, and this Gant fellow is probably the conduit to Washington.
Then you were right to adjourn the talks. We will give them a chance to reconsider their position. If they think they can dictate to us, then they are mistaken. You canceled the airplane order?
Of course, as we agreed last week.
Then that will give them something to think about,
Zhang observed smugly. If they do not walk out of the talks,
they wouldn't dare.
Walk away from the Middle Kingdom? Absurd. There is one other thing that Gant man said. He said, not in so many words, that we need them. Their money, that is, more than they need us. And he is not entirely wrong in that, is he?
We do not need their dollars more than we need our sovereignty. Do they really think they can dictate our domestic laws to us?
Yes, Zhang, they do. They apply an astounding degree of importance to this incident.
Those two policemen ought to be shot for what they did. But we cannot allow the Americans to dictate that sort of thing to us.
The embarrassment of the incident was one thing, and embarrassing the state was often a capital offense in the People's Republic. But China had to make such a decision on its own, not at the order of an outsider. They call it barbaric, Shen added.
Barbaric? They say that to us?
You know that Americans have tender sensibilities. We often forget that. And their religious leaders have some influence in their country. Our ambassador in Washington has cabled some warnings to us about this. It would be better if we had some time to let things settle down. And truly it would be better to punish those two policemen just to assuage American sensibilities. But I agree we cannot allow them to dictate domestic policy to us.
And this Gant man says his G is bigger than ours, does he?
So Shui tells me. Our file on him says that he's a stock trader, that he's worked closely with Minister Winston for many years. He's a Jew, like lots of them are.
Their foreign minister is also a Jew, isn't he?
Minister Adler?
Yes, he is, Shen confirmed after a moment's thought.
So this Gant really does tell us their position, then?
Probably, Foreign Minister Shen said.
Zhang leaned forward in his chair.
Then you will make them clear on ours. The next time you see this Gant, tell him, Choni Marebi.
Which was rather a strong imprecation, best said to someone in China if you had a gun already in your hand.
I understand, Shen replied,
knowing that he'd never say anything like that except to a particularly humble underling in his own office. Zhang left. He had to talk this one over with his friend Fang Gan.
Chapter 34 Hits Over the last week, Ryan had come to expect bad news upon waking up, and as a result, so had his family. He knew that he was taking it too seriously when his children started asking him about it over breakfast.
"What's happening with China, Dad?" Sally asked, giving Ryan one more thing to lament.
Sally didn't say Daddy anymore, and that was a title far more precious to Jack than Mr. President. You expected it from your sons, but not from your daughter. He discussed it with Kathy, but she told him that he just had to roll with the punch.
"We don't know, Sally."
"But you're supposed to know everything." And besides, her friends asked her about it at school.
"Sally, the president doesn't know everything. At least I don't," he explained, looking up from the morning early bird. "And if you never noticed,
The TVs in my office are tuned to CNN and the other news networks because they frequently tell me more than CIA does.
Really?
Sally observed. She watched too many movies. In Hollywood, CIA was a dangerous, law-breaking, anti-democratic, fascist, and thoroughly evil government agency that nonetheless knew everything about everybody, and had really killed President Kennedy for its own purposes, whatever they were. Hollywood never quite got around to that. But it didn't matter, because whoever the star was always managed to thwart the nasty old CIA before the credits, or the last commercial, depending on the format. Really, honey, CIA has some good people in it, but basically it's just one more government agency.
What about the FBI and Secret Service? She asked.
Oh, they're cops. Cops are different. My dad was a cop, remember?
Oh, yeah.
And then she went back to the style section of the Washington Post, which had both the comics and the stories that interested her, mainly ones having to do with the sort of music that her father put quotation marks around. Then there was a discreet knock at the door, and Andrea came in. At this time of day, she also acted as his private secretary, in this case delivering a dispatch from the State Department. Ryan took it, looked at it, and managed not to pound on the table, because his children were present. "Thanks, Andrea," he told her.
"Yes, Mr. President."
And Special Agent Price O'Day went back out to the corridor. Jack saw his wife looking at him. The kids couldn't read all his facial expressions, but his wife could. To Kathy, Ryan couldn't lie worth a damn, which was also why she didn't worry about his fidelity. Jack had the dissimulation ability of a 2-year-old, despite all the help and training he got from Arnie. Jack caught the look and nodded. Yeah, it was China again. 10 minutes later, breakfast was fully consumed and the TV was turned off, and the Ryan family headed downstairs to work, to school, or to the daycare center at Johns Hopkins, depending on age, with the requisite contingent of Secret Service bodyguards. Jack kissed them all in their turn, except for little Jack, shortstop to the Secret Service, because John Patrick Ryan Jr. didn't go in for that sissy stuff. There was something to be said for having daughters, Ryan thought, as he headed for the Oval Office. Ben Goodley was there, waiting with the President's daily brief. "You have the one from Sextate?" Card Sharp asked. "Yeah, Andrea delivered it." Ryan fell into his swivel chair and lifted the phone, punching the proper speed dial button. "Good morning, Jack," Sextate said in greeting, despite a short night's sleep gotten on the convertible sofa in his own office. Fortunately, his private bathroom also had a shower. "Approved. Bring them all back," Swordsman told Eagle. "Who handles the announcement?" Secretary Adler asked. "You do it. We'll try to low-key it," the President said, with forlorn hope in his voice. "Right," Adler thought. "Anything else?" "That's it for now." "Okay, see you, Scott." Ryan replaced the phone. "What about China?" he asked Goodley. "Are they doing anything unusual?" "No, their military is active, but it's routine training activity only. Their most active sectors are up in their northeast and opposite Taiwan. Lesser activity in their southwest, north of India." "With all the good luck the Russians are having with oil and gold, are the Chinese looking north with envy?" "It's not bad speculation, but we have no positive indications of that from any of our sources. Everybody envied rich neighbors, after all. That's what had encouraged Saddam Hussein to invade Kuwait, despite having lots of oil under his own sand." "Any of our sources includes Zorga," the President reminded himself. He pondered that for a second. "Tell Ed I want a snee on Russia and China." "Quick?" Goodley asked. "A special national intelligence estimate could take months to prepare." 3 or 4 weeks. "And I want to be able to hang my hat on it." "I'll tell the DCI," Goodley promised. "Anything else?" Ryan asked.
That's it for now, sir.
Jack nodded and checked his calendar. He had a fairly routine day, but the next one would largely be spent on Air Force One flying hither and yon across America. And he was overnighting in, he flipped the page on the printout, Seattle, before flying home to Washington and another full day. It was just as easy for him to use the VC-25A as a red-eye. Oh yeah, he had a breakfast speech in Seattle to the local JCs. He'd be talking about school reform. That generated a grunt. There just weren't enough nuns to go around. The school sisters of Notre Dame had taught him at St. Matthew's Elementary School in northeast Baltimore back 40-plus years earlier, and taught him well, because the penalty for not learning or for misbehaving did not bear contemplation for a 7-year-old. But the truth of the matter was that he'd been a good and fairly obedient, dull, Jack admitted to himself with a wry smile, child, who'd gotten good marks because he'd had a good mom and a good dad, which was a lot more than too many contemporary American kids could say. And how the hell was he supposed to fix that? Jack asked himself. How could he bring back the ethos of his parents' generation, the importance of religion, and a world in which engaged people went to the altar as virgins? Now they were talking about telling kids that homosexual and lesbian sex was okay. What would Sister Frances Mary have said about that? Jack wondered. A pity she wasn't around to crack some senators and representatives over the knuckles with her ruler. It had worked on him and his classmates at St. Matthew's. The desk speaker buzzed. Senator Smithers just arrived at the west entrance. Ryan stood and went to his right, the door that came in from the secretary's anteroom. For some reason, people preferred that one to the door off the corridor opposite the Roosevelt room. Maybe it was more businesslike. But mainly they liked to see the president standing when the door opened, his hand extended and a smile on his face, as though he really was glad to see them. Sure, Wilbur. Mary Smithers from Iowa, matronly. 3 kids and 7 grandkids, he thought. More talk about the farm bill. What the hell was he supposed to know about farms? The president wondered. On those rare occasions that he purchased food, he did it at the supermarket. Because that's where it all came from, wasn't it? One of the things on the briefing pages for his political appearances was always the local price for bread and milk in case some local reporter tested him. And chocolate milk came from brown cows. Accordingly, Ambassador Hitch and Assistant Secretary Rutledge will be flying back to Washington for consultations, the spokesman told the audience. Does this signal a break in relations with China? A reporter asked at once. Not at all. Consultations means just that. We will discuss the recent developments with our representatives so that our relations with China can more speedily be brought back to what they ought to be, the spokesman replied smoothly. The assembled reporters didn't know what to make of that, and so 3 more questions of virtually identical content were immediately asked, and answers of virtually identical content repeated for them. He's good, Ryan said, watching the TV, which was pirating the CNN and other coverage off the satellites. It wasn't going out live, oddly enough, despite the importance of the news being generated. Not good enough, Arnie Van Dam observed. You're going to get hit with this, too. I figured. When? The next time they catch you in front of a camera, Jack. And he had as much chance of ducking a camera as the leadoff hitter at opening day at Yankee Stadium, the president knew. Cameras at the White House were as numerous as shotguns during duck season, and there was no bag limit here. Christ, Oleg! It took a lot to make Riley gasp, but this one crossed the threshold. Are you serious?
So it would appear, Mishka, Provolov answered.
And why are you telling me? The American asked. Information like this was a state secret equivalent to the inner thoughts of President Grushevoy.
There is no hiding it from you.
I assume you tell everything we do together to Washington, and it was you who identified the Chinese diplomat for which I and my country are in your debt. The amusing part of that was that Riley had darted off to track Suvorov/Konyev without a thought, just as a cop thing, to help out a brother cop. Only afterward, about a nanosecond afterward, of course, had he thought of the political implications. And he'd thought this far ahead, but only as speculation, not quite believing that it could possibly have gone this far forward.
"Well, yes, I have to keep the Bureau informed of my operations here," the legal attaché admitted. Not that it was an earth-shaking revelation.
"I know that, Mishka."
"The Chinese wanted to kill Golovko," Riley whispered into his vodka. "Fuck."
"My word exactly," Provolov told his American friend. "The question is..."
"Two questions, Oleg. First, why? Second, now what?
Third, who is Suvorov? And what is he up to?"
Which was obvious, Riley thought.
Was Suvorov merely a paid agent of a foreign country? Or was he part of the KGB wing of the Russian mafia being paid by the Chinese to do something? But what? And to what purpose?
"You know, I've been hunting OC guys for a long time. But it never got anywhere near this big. This is right up there with all those bullshit stories about who really killed Kennedy."
Provolov's eyes looked up.
"You're not saying..."
"No, Oleg, the mafia isn't that crazy. You don't go around looking to make enemies that big. You can't predict the consequences. And it isn't good for business. The mafia is a business, Oleg. They try to make money for themselves. Even their political protection is aimed only at that, and that has limits, and they know what the limits are."
"So, if Suvorov is mafia, then he is only trying to make money?"
"Here it's a little different," Riley said slowly, trying to help his brain keep up with his mouth. "Here your OC guys think more politically than they do in New York. And the reason for that was that the KGB types had all grown up in an intensely political environment. Here, politics really was power, in a more direct sense, than it had ever been in America, where politics and commerce had always been somewhat separate, the former protecting the latter, for a fee, but also controlled by it. Here it had always been, and still remained, the other way around. Business needed to rule politics because business was the source of prosperity, from which the citizens of a country derived their comforts. Russia had never prospered because the cart kept trying to pull the horse. The recipient of the wealth had always tried to generate that wealth, and political figures are always pretty hopeless in that department. They are only good at squandering it. Politicians live by their political theories. Businessmen use reality and have to perform in a world defined by reality, not theory. That was why, even in America, they understood one another poorly and never really trusted one another.
"What makes Golovko a target? What's the profit in killing him?" Riley asked aloud.
"He is the chief advisor to President Grushevoy. He's never wanted to be an elected official and therefore cannot be a minister per se. But he has the president's ear because he is both intelligent and honest. And he's a patriot in the true sense."
"Despite his background," Riley didn't add.
"Golovko was KGB, formerly a deadly enemy to the West, and an enemy to President Ryan. But somewhere along the line they'd met each other and they'd come to respect each other. Even like each other, so the stories in Washington went." Riley finished off his second vodka and waved for another. He was turning into a Russian, the FBI agent thought. It was getting to the point that he couldn't hold an intelligent conversation without a drink or two. "So get him and thereby hurt your president and thereby hurt your entire country. Still, it's one hell of a dangerous play, Oleg Grigorievich."
"A very dangerous play, Mishka," Provolov agreed. "Who would do such a thing?"
Riley let out a long and speculative breath. "One very ambitious motherfucker." He had to get back to the embassy and light up his Stew 6 in one big fucking hurry.
He'd tell Director Murray, and Murray would tell President Ryan in half a New York minute. Then what?
It was way the hell over his head, Mike Riley thought.
Okay, you're covering this Suvorov guy.
We and the Federal Security Service now, Provolov confirmed.
They good?
Very, the militia lieutenant admitted.
Suvorov can't fart without us knowing what he had to eat.
And you have his communications penetrated?
Oleg nodded.
The written kind.
He has a cell phone, maybe more than one, and covering them can be troublesome.
Especially if he has an encryption system on it. There's stuff commercially available now that our people have a problem with.
Oh? Provolov's head came around.
He was surprised for two reasons. First, that there was a reliable encryption system available for cell phones, and second, that the Americans had trouble cracking it.
Riley nodded.
Fortunately, the bad guys haven't found out yet. Contrary to popular belief, the Mafia wasn't all that adept at using technology. Microwaving their food was about as far as they went. One Mafia don had thought his cell phone secure because of its frequency-hopping abilities, and then had entirely canceled that supposed advantage out by standing still while using it. The dunce don had never figured that out even after the intercept had been played aloud in Federal District Court.
We haven't noticed any of that yet.
Keep it that way, Riley advised. Anyway, you have a national security investigation.
It's still murder and conspiracy to commit murder, Provolov said, meaning it was still his case.
Anything I can do?
Think it over. You have good instincts for Mafia cases, and that is probably what it is.
Riley tossed off his last drink.
Okay, I'll see you tomorrow, right here?
Oleg nodded.
Well, that is good.
The FBI agent walked back outside and got into his car. 10 minutes later, he was at his desk. He took the plastic key from his desk drawer and inserted it into the stew, then dialed Washington. All manner of people with stew phones had access to Murray's private secure number, and so when the large system behind his desk started chirping, he just picked it up and listened to the hiss of static for 30 seconds until the robotic voice announced,
"Line is secure."
"Murray," he said.
"Riley in Moscow," the other voice said.
The FBI director checked his desk clock. It was pretty damn late there.
"What's happening, Mike?" he asked.
Then got the word in 3 fast-spoken minutes.
"Yeah, Ellen?" Ryan said when the buzzer went off.
"The AG and the FBI director want to come over on something important," they said. "You have an opening in 40 minutes.
Fair enough.
Ryan didn't wonder what it was about. He'd find out quickly enough. When he realized what he'd just thought, he cursed the presidency once more. He was becoming jaded.
In this job?
"What the hell?" Ed Foley observed.
"Seems to be solid information, too," Murray told the DCI.
"What else do you know?"
"The facts just came in, only 2 pages and nothing much more than what I just told you, but I'll send it over to you. I've told Riley to offer total cooperation."
"Anything to offer from your side?" Dan asked.
"Nothing comes to mind. This is all news to us, Dan. My congrats to your man Riley for turning it."
Foley was an information whore, after all. He'd take from anybody.
"Good kid. His father was a good agent, too."
Murray knew better than to be smug about it, and Foley didn't deserve the abuse. Things like this were not actually within CIA's purview and not likely to be tumbled to by one of their operations. For his part, Foley wondered if he'd have to tell Murray about Zorga.